Welcome
Thank you
to
for
the
listening.
Sermon Podcast,
Sermon Podcast
Willow Creek Church,
Willow Creek, Winter
Springs, Florida.
May the grace,
Willow Creek,
and the
freedom of our
Lord
and demonstrate the liberating power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You can learn more about our ministry at willowcreekchurch.org.
Bad, bad Leroy Brown. Baddest man in the whole beep town. Badder than old King Kong. Meaner than a junkyard dog. If you're over the age of 40, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Jim Croce. If you're under the age of 40, you have no idea what I'm talking about, but that's okay. I don't have any idea what your music is either. I was listening to that song, Lean On, and you younger folks know the lyrics go, blow a kiss, fire a gun. I actually thought that it was saying Louis Farrakhan. And you younger people probably don't have any idea who he is, but that's clearly how out of touch I am on your end of the spectrum. I will completely forgive you for being out of touch on our end of the spectrum. If there was a bad, bad Leroy Brown in the Bible, his name might be Jephthah. And I want to turn your attention to Judges chapter 11 and just look at the first few verses as we see his background. Now, Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty warrior. But he was the son of a prostitute. Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife also bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in your father's house, for you are the son of another woman." Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows collected around Jephthah and went out with him. That's the background of this judge's life. I was commenting in the back room before we came out for worship with our praise musicians that one of the things you see in the book of Judges is a cycle repeated in the age of every judge where God's people experience a measure of prosperity. And in their prosperity, they're given over to pride and self-reliance. That prideful self-reliance gives way by God's grace, a severe mercy, to peril. God allows them to experience a taste of the bitter fruit of what it means to live apart from him. And then they cry out to God. They make pleas, and then God provides them in his grace and lavish mercy a deliverer. And that cycle, that fivefold cycle of the judges, repeats itself over and over again throughout the book. But there's another dynamic at work in the book of Judges that's not immediately apparent in any particular judge's life. You have to read the entire book to see it. And it's like an airplane coming down out of the skies, getting ready to crash. At the beginning of the book of Judges, the judges are fairly okay. They live in a godless age when everybody is doing what's right in their own eyes rather than what's right in the eyes of God. But the early judges, more or less, are pretty good people. But by the end of the book of Judges, the condition of Israel is so deteriorated that even its deliverers are deeply flawed individuals. Jephthah's background plays into this. Jephthah was born into a house and he was unwanted. He was born to a prostitute, which is not exactly a resume builder. It's not something you put on your college application. Nobody looks at your college application and says, "Oh, your grades were mediocre, but oh, I notice you were born to a prostitute. So welcome to Harvard." This guy's life is a mess before it even really begins. He's doomed to be an outcast. He's doomed to be marginalized, and he is. As Gilead's wife bears him sons, those sons are born and see Jephthah as an outsider, a person who doesn't belong. I don't know all of your stories. I know some of your stories after being here for almost 3 years. I imagine many of you in this room this morning can look back on your past to remember some deep hurts from your childhood. I remember one time getting ready to go to school and finding the kid down the street waiting for me at the bus stop. And I remember I was wearing some clothes that my parents had bought for me. And during that time, finances weren't that great. And I knew it was a sacrifice for them to purchase what they bought for me. But as I was walking down to the bus stop, this kid made some really sarcastic remarks about the way that I looked. And I was embarrassed. And I was torn. Part of me wanted to run home and change into something else that would meet with his approval and maybe make me feel accepted. But the other part of me loved my parents too much. I didn't want to hurt their feelings. They were sacrificing to provide for us. I didn't want to run home and tell them that what they were giving wasn't good enough. I'm 43 years old. That probably happened 35 years ago. And I still remember it with pain. I imagine every one of us in this room can remember formative experiences from our early life that were painful and in some sense defining. And the same is true for people living in ancient times. There was no way that Jephthah's life was not in some way defined by these early experiences. The people around him were crafting for him an identity, and that identity became the all-defining source of the way he'd live his life. Maligned, cast aside, Jephthah was put out of his own house. And the Bible tells us that he went on to live in view of what the world told him about himself. Verse 4, after a time, the Ammonites made war against Israel. And when the Ammonites made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah from the land of Tob. He's living in the land of Tob, and you remember from what we read just moments ago, he was living with what the Hebrew describes as vain, but perhaps better defined as worthless individuals. You see, when the world tells you that you are inadequate, your heart doesn't oftentimes leave it there. When the world tells you that you don't measure up, the pain of that declaration oftentimes gets translated into your heart as a message much worse. It's not simply that you don't measure up. It's that you don't have worth. And Jephthah made his new family, his new fellowship with men the Bible calls worthless. I want you to know this morning, no matter how deep your pain over previous experiences, no matter how many faulty and cynical and harsh messages you've heard about who you are, nobody is worthless because we've been created in the image of a God of infinite worth. Every single person that's ever walked this earth is created in the image and likeness of God. Now, it's true that we debase ourselves. We've rejected that God. We've gone to live a completely different life, independent of Him. And as a result, we so easily forget. And sometimes we even actively suppress that knowledge of God's love. But it doesn't change the immutable, objective truth that He created us. Jephthah lived a life with, quote unquote, worthless men. I had a good friend who was an addict. He was addicted to heroin for several years of his life. He was actually incarcerated for a time. And by God's grace, he was liberated from that addiction. But I remember with him sharing with me his story, that one of the things addicts do when they find themselves in the throes of addiction is they either try to get those around them to share in their addiction, or they surround themselves with others who share that addiction. And one of the reasons for that desire for fellowship with fellow addicted persons is that the contrast isn't as great and isn't as cutting. They don't feel as badly about themselves when they're in the presence of others who are similarly afflicted. You know, when I was growing up in the church, I used to think that the purpose of church was to teach me to be a good person. I used to think the purpose of church in the Bible was to show a different way of living life. And that the purpose of going and hearing a message on Sunday morning was to hear from somebody who finally figured out how to get it all together. And then if I could just stay at their feet and listen long enough, then eventually I would learn the secret to getting it all together myself. I thought that Christianity was a message of moral improvement. And I tried to hang with those who had it together, hoping that their success would rub off on me. That if I could prove myself to be worthy to be in their fellowship, that it would somehow authenticate me. That was one of them. That I was good like them. But the longer I lived, the more I gradually realized I'm not good. And I'm not getting it together. Sure, there's growth in some areas. But my spiritual growth is a series of stops and starts. Advances and retreats. Sometimes horrible, grievous retreats. And I was demoralized. And I found through that the company of the similarly demoralized is a whole lot more refreshing and energizing than the company of those who have it all together. And I imagine for one reason or another, Jephthah found his home among these fellow worthless individuals, quote unquote, because it was soothing to him. He wasn't an outsider anymore. He wasn't being reminded day to day of his insufficiencies, of how much he didn't fit in. Now, of course, he did it in a sinful way. These were probably marauders and thieves. They were bullies, gangsters of the age. And he became the equivalent of a mob boss. But you know, the church can really be something similar, albeit in a much more noble way. Every church faces a choice, whether it's going to be the communion of those who are faking it and pretend to have it all together, a community of liars who present themselves with a series of false fronts designed to stoke the mythology that they've got it all together and to get those around them to go along with the thing that deep down we all know isn't true, or a church can be real and authentic. Church can be a place where people come in and they're broken, they're wounded, and they don't have to hide. It can be the one place in a person's week where they come to hear the message that they don't need to hide anymore. They don't need to pretend anymore. They don't need to fake. They can expose themselves for who they are and find not judgment, but hope, healing. As Jephthah grew in that identity and found those around him who could reinforce that identity, he acted more and more in view of that identity. And that's what I want to really draw your attention to this morning that I think is so beautiful about the gospel of Jesus Christ and the hope that we have. So we read in verse 5 that the Ammonites made war against Israel. The elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, listen carefully, come and be our leader, that we may fight against the Ammonites. But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, did you not hate me and drive me out of my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you're in distress? And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, that's why we've turned to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the Ammonites and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, now listen carefully, if you bring me home again to fight against the Ammonites, and the Lord gives them over to me, I will be your head. And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord will be witness between us if we do not do as you say. So Jephthah went to the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and leader over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. What's happened here? Well, Jephthah has been cast out. He's been maligned. He's been told from the youngest of age he's worthless. He doesn't matter. And it's hardened him. And he's gone into the wilderness and he's found other hardened men with whom to live life and have fellowship. And they've become outcasts. And no doubt, aggressive. They've become fierce. And then out of all that woundedness and brokenness, God makes a warrior. Notice back in verse 1 what God says of Jephthah, the Gileadite. He says, now Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior. The same was said of Gideon. But it was said of Gideon when he was cowering in fear, threshing wheat with a wine press, so that the enemies of Israel wouldn't know what he was doing. God eventually led Gideon from his fear into his status as a mighty warrior. But here we see, listen carefully, God has made Jephthah a mighty warrior, but how has he done it? Through adversity. Through affliction. And let's just be honest, through sin. God has used sin. Sin done against Jephthah. The sin of Jephthah against others. Listen, to prepare Jephthah for a holy purpose. I had a professor in seminary who said God can draw straight lines with crooked sticks. And God can draw straight lines with crooked people. Sometimes we think that our former sins, and I'm not talking about the common sins that Christians confess so easily. I didn't do my devotions, or I don't pray enough, or I've been a little lazy when it comes to Sunday school, and I went to Wednesdays at Willow for 3 weeks, but I haven't been back since. Not those kind of sins. I'm talking about the sins that we don't even want to name. The sins that you don't even want to quietly name in your mind when you're praying to God. Because even though you're a follower of God, a disciple of Jesus, and you trust His words, you're still not ready yet to bring that sin to God with confidence. Because it's too painful. God can use even that sin to make you a mighty warrior in His kingdom. He can do the same with the sin done to you. I've not been a pastor for 1,000 years by any stretch, but I have been a pastor a little longer than just a few years. And I know in any body of the church, any expression of the visible body of Christ, there are people who have been wounded and hurt in ways they would much rather suppress than ever let see the light of day. I'm sure that there are people in our church, in our family, who have been so wronged, they doubt that God could bring healing in this life. I'm sure there are people in our church who've gone through things that they've never told anybody, and they can't possibly understand how God could bring any good through that experience. Jephthah shows us something amazing. The wrong done to him was not good. It was evil. It was wicked. It was from the bowels of hell. Telling a child of God that they are not a child of God. Defining them by things like being born to the wrong person, having the wrong background, the wrong pedigree, telling them that they are, all of those things is the work of the accuser, Satan. It's not the work of God. But it doesn't mean that God can't use it. And it doesn't mean that God won't allow His redemption to shine in it and through it. The truth is, the Gileadites were humbled. They came to the end of themselves. Their pedigree, their identity, no longer good enough. They knew they had nothing. And now they were being threatened. And in their desperation, their delusions of self-sufficiency were gone. In the artificial categories that we create with our neighbors and our family members and others, these evaporated. Suddenly, Jephthah was not a tool to make themselves feel better about themselves. Suddenly, Jephthah was their only hope of survival. And in that humility, albeit a flawed humility, not a godly humility, an opportunistic humility, they come to Him and say, "You have to deliver us." And Jephthah says, "I will. But I will be exalted in your house. I'm not only going to be allowed in your house, I'm going to own your house. If I'm going to be your deliverer, I'm going to be your Lord. So desperate are they. They say, okay. And Jephthah goes out against the enemies of Israel. And he doesn't go immediately to war. He's shrewd. I don't think it's unnatural or artificial to liken him to a crime boss. He knows the ways of the world. He's been cast out into it. And so he goes to the enemies of Israel and says, look, we're going to fight. But we don't have to fight. We can resolve this if you want to. If you don't want to, it's go time. And through a series of back and forth, the enemy of Israel lying and trying to misrepresent history, Jephthah just patiently corrects him, theologically, historically, in every way correcting the record and establishing that war, if it's to be had, is, even in such a crooked age, just. And then Jephthah leads God's people in war. And they go out. It seems like the trajectory of Jephthah's life is good. But just as it's true of you and true of me, that whatever growth we have in this life is a series of starts and stops, of advances and retreats, so it was with Jephthah. The Bible commands us to be renewed in our mind, to have our perspective transformed so that we would share more and more the mind of Christ. That's a process. That's not an event. And our success in that regard is always partial in this life. It's never complete. And so we live divided lives, intellectually, with our affections, and even with our practice as it radiates outward from there. And so it was with Jephthah. He was coming into an understanding of his call from God, but at the same time was still living at least partially in view of that former identity. And so he makes a barter with God. See, Jephthah doesn't believe in a God of grace. He believes in a God of works. Not the God of Israel who revealed himself as a God of grace, but a God that he interprets through the lens of the gods and the culture around him. Because he's not been renewed in his mind to think of God the way that he's revealed himself. He thinks of God the way that the world reveals him, a God that must be appeased if he's going to work for us. A God that can be bought off with promises and good behavior. And so Jephthah makes the most unfortunate pledge to God. He says, if you'll give me victory in this battle, I will sacrifice the first thing that comes out of my house upon my return. And it's his daughter. And it's an indication of how deeply dark spiritually Israel was at this time, and how dark and Jephthah was in his own understanding. He fulfills that vow, albeit after a time of mourning. There's no real way to explain away what Jephthah did. It is every bit as sinful and as vile as it appears to be. And it's a good warning for us that when we allow the world to be the lens through which we look at God, and we allow the world's voices to determine how we look at one another, our vision is skewed. Our perspective is off. And if our perspective is off, so are our priorities. And our priorities give birth to practices that are wrong. If we view God more and more as he's revealed himself, and if we view ourselves more and more as God has revealed us to be, and if we view our neighbor more and more as God has revealed our neighbor to be, even our enemies as God reveals them to be, that perspective informs our priorities. And our priorities shift, become more and more in line with the affections, the heart of God, and then out from there comes a life lived increasingly for his glory. Jephthah didn't see that realized in his life. And we won't see that perfectly realized in our own. But by God's grace, his lavish mercy, He can rescue us from so much error and free us to live a new kind of life. And that new kind of life does not come by our efforts. It comes entirely by God's grace. It comes by the grace of our deliverer, a greater judge than Jephthah, Ehud, Othniel, Deborah, Barak, any that have been previously mentioned. A greater judge and deliverer than any deliverer revealed in the Old Testament, even David. Our deliverer is Christ. And he comes to us by grace. The grace of God who sent him and had him born in a scandalous way. Jephthah born to a prostitute, maligned for his birth. Jesus born to a virgin, maligned in his birth. Jephthah cast out by his brothers. Not viewed as truly one of them. Jesus' earthly brothers, both within the family of Joseph and Mary, but also more broadly in the nation of Israel, rejected him and cast him out. And as Jephthah was cast out, he became prepared, uniquely suited to be the deliverer. And Jesus is our great deliverer. The one who says, I will redeem you. But if I redeem you, know this. I'll be your head. But there's no fear in the headship of Christ. There's only comfort. There's only peace. There's only a source of security and satisfaction that the world can never give. A comfort, a grace that soothes our deepest hurts. It reminds us that in His house, where He is our King, our Head, our Lord, who was our Deliverer, He will wipe every tear from our eyes. But not only will He do that in a future day, He will take everything that we've ever formed against Him, everything that's ever been formed against us, and He'll turn it around and use it. So that's my encouragement for you this morning and my charge. I want you to think deeply. How does your deepest hurt? How will God use that to equip you to minister His grace to yourself, to those around you? How has God shaped you, not only in the good things of life, but in the deeply painful, horrible things that you can't even bear to mention? God is there too.
Thank you for listening to the sermon podcast of Willow Creek Church. May the grace, peace, and freedom of our Lord be yours.